Speaking on this program is Brother Winford Claiborne.
Thank you and good morning. A few weeks ago, 3 8-year-old boys were riding bicycles in their neighborhood in West Memphis, Arkansas, a city of about 20,000 residents, directly across the Mississippi River from Memphis, Tennessee. These three little boys just simply disappeared, which caused great concern for their families and friends. The next day after the boys disappeared, they were found in a drainage ditch. According to news reports, the three boys had died from blows to their heads. They had also been sexually molested. The pictures of these handsome and pleasant-looking boys appeared in the commercial appeal. They had the looks of little boys you could not keep from liking. The Tennessean, on Sunday, June the 6th, 1993, explained that three teenage boys, ages 16, 17, and 18, had been arrested for the brutal murder of these 3 8-year-old boys. Page 1A. The Tennessean reported that the three teenage murderers were apparently worshipers of Satan. The 18-year-old, Michael Wayne Eccles, who calls himself Damien, says he worships the devil and engages in other occult practices. On June the 8th, 1993, the Tennessean quotes one of the teenagers, Jesse Lloyd Miss Kelly, Jr., 17, as saying that the cult to which he belonged required its prospective members to engage in mutilation, rape, and eating dog legs. Page 4A. The tragedy which I have just related to you is beyond my comprehension. I can imagine a man's becoming so angry that he kills another, or he gets so drunk he kills, even without knowing it. But I cannot understand how three teenage boys kill three beautiful 8-year-olds just to join or to continue in a satanic cult. How can anyone's mind become so warped that he commits such unspeakable evil? As we think about so many incidents of this kind I have just described, a question is in order. What could the parents of the 3 8-year-old boys have done to prevent such a senseless waste of their children? I honestly wish I could tell you that I have the answer to that question, but I do not. Nor do I know anyone who does have the answer. Even though I do not have all the answers, it is appropriate that I discuss with you today protecting our children. Please listen carefully to our study. If you have questions or comments, please let me hear from you. Do I need to tell you how important our children are and what God expects of us in relationship to them? Our children are the future of the church, of the nation, and of the world. No nation can long endure and fulfill its place in the world when it ceases to care for its children and young people. D. Jepson, wife of former U.S. Senator Roger Jepson of Iowa, made the following comments about the importance of mothers taking care of their children. Women are primarily responsible for passing on our culture, passing on our values, and for shaping and molding the young lives of the leaders of tomorrow. We women have often been taken for granted, and seldom taken seriously by many in our society. D. Jepson's book has the title, Women Beyond Equal Rights. If our children are not of vital importance, what difference could it possibly make who teaches them or whether or not they are taught? The children of our nation are so important. They deserve the very best fathers and mothers have to offer. Parents can do no better work than to care for their children, to see that the children grow into decent and God-fearing men and women. Are our children not worth protecting? Obviously, the best perspective on the value of children is what God Himself has revealed in His inspired Word. The psalmist wrote as follows, Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of the mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate. Psalm 127:3-5. Because of the enormous value God attaches to children, he often gave parents instruction regarding the rearing of the offspring. The wise man Solomon wrote, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old he will not depart from it." Proverbs 22:6. The New Testament speaks just as emphatically about the significance of teaching and disciplining our children. And you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Ephesians 6:4. Dr. Paul Meyer, an internationally respected Dallas psychiatrist, and Linda Burnett, a Dallas housewife and the mother of three, wrote an excellent book with the title, The Unwanted Generation. In this book, they discuss at length what should be very disturbing to all concerned Americans, especially to those who call themselves Christians. We are a people who seem not to like nor to want children. The primary thrust of their splendid book, incidentally, is not abortion or infanticide, although they discuss both. They are deeply disturbed, and with good reason, at Americans' indifference to the welfare of our children and our young people. Dr. Meyer and Linda Burnett quote from a survey published by Ann Landers. In 1976, Ann Landers polled her millions of readers with the question, "If you had it to do over again, would you have children?" Mrs. Landers, herself a mother and a grandmother, was surprised that 70% said no. Page 14. What better example could I give you of our almost total disregard for the value of all children, than the fact that our government allows the killing of 4,000 babies per day, 4,000 babies per day by abortion? That, dear friends, is 1,600,000 human beings deliberately and maliciously destroyed per year, primarily because they are not wanted. How can our nation avoid reaping what we have sown in the killing of our beautiful babies? Marietta P. Stanton, a registered nurse and an associate professor and director of the Continuing Education Program for the School of Nursing at the State University of New York at Buffalo, has written a recent book with the title, Our Children Are Dying, Recognizing the Dangers and Knowing What to Do. Dr. Stanton gives a great amount of information about the deaths of American children and what we as a nation must do about it. Her book was written in 1990 and is based on statistics from 1987. In the preface to her book, Dr. Stanton gives an overview of the great losses this nation suffers because of the deaths of our children. From sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS, and skyrocketing infant mortality, to accidental poisonings and drug or alcohol-related deaths, from backyard pool drowning to prom night head-on collisions, from child abuse to teenage homicide and suicide, the list of problems that threaten to snuff out precious young lives is growing at an alarming rate, and the national death toll is rising. How much potential greatness has already been lost to us? The death of a child represents a unique contribution to society that can never be realized. Pages 7 and 8. Dr. Stanton lists some facts and figures about infant mortality, which are startling and inexcusable. She affirms that similar statistics can be found in every age group of children. Please listen carefully to these statistics about the deaths of our children. Each year, approximately 40,000 babies die in the first 12 months of life. Let me add one fact which Dr. Stanton overlooks. 40,000 children die every 10 days by the hands of their mothers and by the cruelty of doctors who kill babies for hire. Of all newborns, 6 8/10% suffer from low birth weight, less than 5.5 pounds. 16% of all low birth weight babies are severely handicapped. Congenital defects in newborns, which are detectable by screening, go undetected, resulting in death or mental retardation, 4,500 cases annually. Congenital defects are a leading cause of death in babies less than 28 days old. Of women in their childbearing years, 15 to 44 years of age, 13 million lack coverage for medical expenses. Poor, minority, and unmarried women are overrepresented among the uninsured. In 1986, 1,200 deaths were directly related to child abuse. There were 24,000 injuries. There were over 1 million reports of child abuse in 1983. The most common perpetrators of child abuse are the parents. In 1985 alone, 1,900,000 cases of abuse or neglect were reported. Accidents are the leading cause of childhood death in most age groups beyond infancy. This includes vehicular accidents as well as falls, drownings, death by fire, and so on. Each year, more than 15 million children are injured seriously enough to require medical attention. From 1979 to 1982, vehicle accidents were the second leading cause of death in children under 1 year of age, and the leading cause of all deaths in young people aged 1 to 19 years. Motor vehicle accidents account for one of every five deaths in children aged 1 to 14. Two of every five deaths in adolescents are related to motor vehicle accidents. 62% of tested drivers aged 16 to 19 had positive blood alcohol levels. Vital Statistics reports from many urban settings now rank homicide as the third leading cause of death in teenagers. The most frequent perpetrators of teenage homicide are acquaintances. Causes of teenage violence resulting in homicide are most often related to drugs, alcohol, or gang-type activities. In 1983, over 200 children between 5 and 14 years of age committed suicide. This accounts for a little over 2% of the deaths in this age group that year. A 13% increase in suicide for this age group is projected by the year 2000. Suicide accounts for about 12% of all deaths in teenagers. There is a 94% increase in suicides projected for 15 to 19-year-olds by the year 2000. For every death by drowning, there are at least three by suicide. For every three homicides in the United States, there are four suicides. For every two deaths resulting from automobile accidents, one young person somewhere commits suicide. Suicide is the second or third highest cause of death among college students, pages 18 and 19. Dr. Stanton divides infancy into two stages, neonatal, first 28 days of a child's departure from the womb, and postnatal, from the 28th day to the end of the first year of the child's life. During the neonatal period, according to Dr. Stanton, the leading cause of death is congenital anomalies or irregularities. There are 5,700 deaths among neonates every year. The vast majority of these death-producing birth defects are associated with an abnormality of the physical structure of the heart, in the circulatory system, or in the respiratory system. Page 26. The second leading cause of death in this neonatal period is disorders related to premature delivery and low birth weight. There are more than 3,300 of these deaths every year. The third leading cause of death in neonates is respiratory distress syndrome, which is produced by a variety of factors associated with an underdeveloped respiratory system which fails to function properly. Pages 26 and 27. During the postnatal period, from 28 days to 1 year, the leading cause of death is SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. 4,500 deaths occur every year in this country because of SIDS. The second leading cause of death at this stage of development is birth defects, conditions with which a child is born, and which involves defects associated with the heart, circulatory system, and respiratory system. The third leading cause of death is accidents. Dr. Stanton says that many children in the United States receive a death sentence at the moment of conception. Pages 27 and 28. Obviously, we do not, and maybe cannot, know all the reasons children are born defective. Defective children have been born for thousands of years. It likely will continue into the foreseeable future, unless we decide to abort all defective babies, or to kill them if they escape the abortionist knives, poisons, and suction machines. One of the major reasons children are born defective is that many of them are born to teenagers. Teenagers were not designed to have babies and should not have them. Babies born to teenagers are at great risk for physical and mental abnormalities. Dr. Stanton affirms that high-risk women tend to be teenagers, unmarried, and non-white. Page 31. Millions of teenage girls are using alcohol and other drugs. Low birth weight babies and handicapped babies are often born to women, both teenagers and older women, who abuse alcohol and other drugs. Incidentally, nobody knows just how much alcohol a woman has to drink to cause her child to be handicapped. Doctors are almost universally agreed that women ought not to drink at all if they are pregnant or think they are. The advice is unquestionably valid, but it is not adequate. Doctors and other professionals who work with young women, whether or not the young women are pregnant, have a moral obligation to encourage them not to drink, ever. The damage to a young woman's body may be severe, whether or not she ever becomes pregnant. The only safe course, young men and young women, is to leave alcohol and other drugs alone. Do you remember King Solomon's words about beverage alcohol? At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Proverbs 23:32. Nobody, young people, has a right to abuse his or her body in such a way that unborn babies will be afflicted or handicapped. If you believe the golden rule, you will not drink because of what drinking does to your own body, the lives of your children, and to society in general. But a teenager does not have to drink or abuse drugs to have defective babies. The very fact that a young woman is not fully developed physically means that babies born to such women are at high risk for being handicapped. The immaturity of a teenager's body presents some real problems when the teenager becomes pregnant and attempts to deliver a baby. We must encourage our young women to wait to have babies until they are mature physically, emotionally, and mentally. As a nation, we pay the consequences when we fail to do so. Tragically, teenagers often smoke, use alcohol, and other dangerous drugs, but they also fail to follow proper nutritional guidelines. They become infected with sexually transmitted diseases and refuse to see a doctor until late in their pregnancies, if at all. This is a prescription for a dismal situation so far as both the teenager and her baby are concerned. It is also tragic for our nation and for the world. We are having to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on situations which should never have been allowed to develop. Liberal theologians, the irresponsible media, radical university professors, and unconcerned parents must share the major blame for our current situation. Of course, the girls themselves and their consorts are not guilt-free either. There is another element in the equation which was not present 20 years ago. At least, we were not aware of it, if it existed at all. I am speaking about the modern tragedy called AIDS. AIDS has become a major threat to hundreds of thousands of our teenage women. If a woman, whether or not she is a teenager, is HIV positive when she delivers a baby, there is a good chance that the baby will be born HIV positive. There are literally thousands of these babies in major cities like New York, San Francisco, Miami, and Atlanta, and the numbers are increasing at an alarming rate. My friends, there is a biblical solution to many of the problems I have outlined for you today. This does not mean that Christian people do not also have handicapped babies, or do not lose babies by death, the same kinds of deaths which trouble other families. It does mean that Christians will avoid some situations which are almost guaranteed recipes for death and decay, both for their children and for themselves. I beg you to listen carefully to the next 5 minutes of our discussion. Churches must take a stand against premarital sex. The Bible specifically and emphatically condemns premarital sex all the time, everywhere, for all people. If we Christians are going to be faithful to our calling, we must teach our young people to use the strength and influence of the church to discipline all members, old and young alike. How many churches think they are being faithful to God when they sit on the sidelines and do nothing about the sexual promiscuity running rampant in our land? Parents are the front line of defense against whatever adversely affects our children. The community, the school, and the church have serious responsibilities toward our infants, children, and young people. But the major task of rearing children belongs to the parents. Parents are required by divine command to bring up their children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Ephesians 6:4. We cannot complain that other institutions of our society are not doing enough for their children. This is our responsibility, yours and mine. What I'm about to tell you is not untypical for American fathers. The father of a teenage boy decides it is time for him to talk with his son about the facts of life and love. He calls his son into his office and gives him some advice, somewhat as follows. Son, I want you to learn to accept responsibility for your behavior. If you are going to be sexually active, he says with a sly grin as he hands his son a package of contraceptives, be sure to protect yourself and the young women with whom you have sex. What do you think this father has just done for his son? He has given explicit instructions regarding sexual exploitation of young women and implicit endorsement of such behavior. Does such a father think his son is so naive or so stupid? He does not understand the father's words. And then we wonder why there is an epidemic of teenage pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases, including the deadly AIDS. Telling young people to protect themselves is signing the death warrant for thousands and thousands of our teenagers and for the children, 600,000 who will be born to teenagers this year. So-called safe sex is an inexcusable cop-out for parents and for other leaders of young people. The only safe sex for anyone is refraining from sex until he gets married and being faithful to his spouse as long as they both shall live. If we think and preach otherwise, we not only are deceiving ourselves, we are destroying our country. Our young people must be taught the dangers of alcohol and other drugs. By teaching them to just say no, we'll not get the job done. We must furnish them a solid basis for rejecting alcohol and other drugs. That includes parents refraining from these death-dealing drugs, including alcohol. How tremendously inconsistent for parents to criticize their children's use of drugs, such as marijuana, cocaine, and heroin, when the parents have beer in the refrigerator and stronger drink in their liquor cabinets. Do you honestly believe the child does not see through your hypocrisy? When teenage girls do become pregnant, and they will, in spite of our very best efforts to prevent it, we must help them to learn what it means to take care of themselves. They should be encouraged to go to a medical doctor early in their pregnancies. I know of some of the problems in trying to work with pregnant teenagers, but we must help in every way we possibly can. Do you not think God will hold us accountable if we fail to try? The Lord willing, I shall continue next Sunday to talk with you on the topic, protecting our children. Thank you for listening, and may God bless you.